position number 21577, wheel 2.
San Bowell, reel 2.
Yes, so we had quite a good time. We sort of get bonds of friendship, you know, we became good friends, especially going to show in, as you say, in Malta. We didn't stray very far from the bars and the, you know, the various places where sailors went in Valletta. I've been since with my family. I managed to get to lose them in Malta and walk down the Strata Stretta, which is called the Gut, as it was called, you know. And I still got an inside navy. I was about 55 at the time. They were still standing outside. Very few compared to what they used to be, maybe about 6 when there used to be about 50 bars, you know. And it was quite funny, really. We did one or two tours of Malta, and we had a leading seaman in our mess who was a regular, never went ashore. I mean, they'd done it all before, and he was a married bloke, and all the sort of things that were on offer in Malta didn't interest him. But he did organise two coach trips around Malta for us lads sort of thing who hadn't been, which was quite good of him. And in fact, I've heard of him comparatively recently. So that was more or less Malta. And then, of course, the next thing, it was full steam ahead, back to Gibraltar, back through the bay to Plymouth. A few days leave, back to the ship, thought we were going to, it's a bit rude really, but it's interesting, about my pal Ginger Harvey, who'd married a school teacher while he was on leave. And he, straight away, you know, the first day he'd married the school teacher, and he came back, he said, I don't know, he said, she'll only do what she reads in a book. And she'd been reading this book about health and the like, and it said sex was only good for you once a week. So I want to go around. I think we were hoping to go back on leave again. You know, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen. We hoped. So he spent a full Saturday afternoon looking in the bookshops for another book that had a more that allowed him a more regular. That at least more than once a week. He said, I don't want to go home on leave for another week. And anyway, because she was, you know, what school teachers are like. But we didn't get another leave. We sailed for the Firth of Forth. And we made air guard under the Forth Bridge. Ready for if the, you know, the Germans came to bombed the Forth Bridge, and I thought at the time there's a good chance that we'll blow the bloody Forth Bridge off, you know, in your excitement, firing at the aircraft. It was a very vulnerable position, really, wasn't it? You can imagine. And then, of course, the trouble started in Norway. This would be April 40. We went up to Scapa Flow, loaded up with soldiers, and sailed for Norway. And I've forgotten the first place we got. I think it was Namsos, our first port of call, where we unloaded the soldiers. We went to more than one place. Went to Andelsnes, Namsos. We never went to Narvik, mainly, and Molde, another place called Molde. All little places up the fjords. I've been since and had a look around. But while we were in Namsos, I can remember now, we unloaded these British soldiers, and really, they didn't impress us very much, because the rifles were all over the ship. They didn't seem to be very well-trained soldiers. I don't think they were. I don't think they'd been trained very long. And then we came back to the UK, and we reloaded with French Chasseurs Alpins. I believe that's the correct name. And they were all well-trained, regular soldiers. And you never saw any of them let his rifle more than a foot away from him all the trip, even though it was rough and they were seasick. They were self-contained fighting men. I suppose the difference was between SAS and ordinary regiments. And we landed those in Norway. And then, of course, while we were landing, we got constantly attacked by Ju-87s, because they were the only ones that could come over the mountains and dive at you in the fjords. So the first time we had the Ju-87s coming at us, we thought, well, right, Queen Bees, here we go. But these Ju-87s, they were much higher than the Queen Bees, and they got to the 45 degrees, and they didn't dive, and they got to a much steeper angle, they still didn't dive. We thought, oh, well, they haven't seen us, they're going over us. And then they got to about 80 degrees, tipped up and came screaming down at us. Well, our gunnery, and all the gunnery the Navy had worked out over the years, didn't take account of this. They were stuck. I mean, our gunnery just couldn't cope with it, because we had to load the guns, get them up, get them down, reload, get them. We hadn't time to do it all. All the scheme had been, all these admirals and clever officers being paid whatever they were in the Navy over all these years, and not taken into account the fact that these Ju-87s or whatever they were would dive virtually vertical at you. You can imagine it, can't you, with big guns? So our gunnery officer had to very quickly do some calculations and the like and sort out a scheme for dealing with them. And we ended up where we used to, for a twin gun, the rounds were very heavy. I don't know the exact weight, but to be able to punch them up with your fist, because you'd hold them in one arm and punch them up with your fist. If the guns were at quite a steep incline, it was very physical to do it. Well, our gunnery system that we evolved worked out that we fired 24 rounds a minute from a twin 4-inch mounting, which allowed us 5 seconds to load the rounds, elevate the gun to the point where the director and TS were giving the information for, fire the gun, and then the ejected cartridges would bash out onto the deck because you're at a high angle. They had to be moved and have the new rounds fused and up, and we only had 5 seconds to do it. So you can imagine, it was quite a job. So the Carlisle, if all guns were firing, 4 twins, had, how many did I say, 24 rounds a mounting in a minute. Every 5 seconds you have a twin, haven't you? That's 24. So 4 times that, 96 rounds. We could put 96 rounds of HA up at aircraft in a minute. And when you think about it, it's some physical. It was physical, very physical. Fortunately, I wasn't doing the physical part, but I had to deal with the... And this first attack, well, the first attack that we had a chief petty officer. I was captain of the gun with the chief petty officer gunner's mate, and we had Lieutenant Evans, who was an RNVR lieutenant from Hull. His father was Dr. Evans. I don't know whether he knew them at all. And the first bombs that were dropped at us from the first attack, the shrapnel wounded this chief petty officer. And he had to go away, and he was no longer there. So that left Evans, who was green as grass, really, and myself, to run this foreign mountain and to try and make sure we could keep up with this tremendous firing rate, you know. I mean, you could only keep that up for 2 or 3 minutes, because the aircraft only didn't take that long to come down at you. We used to fire actually at the aircraft. And then we had another scheme, a barrage, which meant that we put a barrage up in the area which we thought that if the aircraft came through, would shoot them down. In other words, there's a certain point where the aircraft has got to come through to drop its bombs to hit you. You know, if you work out the angles geometrically, or and so we used to put a barrage into that area to try and put them off. I think we claimed 5 aircraft, but we're only credited with 2 for sure. That was more or less the setup. But you were a sitting duck, you see. You were stuck in a fjord. You couldn't manoeuvre. And if the aircraft came, and also your radar couldn't pick the aircraft up because of the size of the fjord. See, they would come in and suddenly appear. And you really, the other thing as well, in the Norwegian company, you didn't get any sleep. Because, you know, April in Norway means about 3 or 4 hours darkness. So you were subject to attack most of the time. And while we're in Namsos, we're alongside a jetty with a ship called the Arab, which was an armed trawler. And it was doing the same as we were, you know, it was sort of... by this time, we're evacuating as against landing. The whole thing changed. We started evacuating. And the Arab, the captain of the Arab, Lieutenant Commander Stannard, got one of the first VCs of the war in this action while we're alongside. You maybe have you read about him at all? I've got a book there of all VCs of the last war, and he's listed in that, if you're interested in it. Maybe you're not. He was, I didn't see anything why, we didn't see any reason why he should have got a VC, but when we left, the Arab was left alongside. I think eventually it was sunk and they took to the hills, and that's when he showed his particular qualities. So then we eventually sailed with whatever people we could. I've left some gaps, but you can't remember everything. We sailed with the soldiers we'd evacuated, as many as we could. Most of them were left there, as you maybe know. But we sailed, and as we came out, the ship ahead of us was the Afridi, which was the ship I'd seen as a boy. And we were attacked by Stukas. And as the Stukas came down, the Afridi were travelling at our fastest speed and taking avoiding action, which was a big thing. The captain used to look at the aircraft and decide when the bombs left the aircraft whether what course to steer. Either steer into them or steer away, whatever. Well, the Afridi had a look at the aircraft, made the wrong decision and steered right into the bombs. And as she went along, really heeling over as she sped along, they could do over 40 knots, those. The bombs hit her on the side and she just turned over. And that was the ship that I used to look at this picture of and think I'd like to be in the Navy.
Did you see this?
Yeah, that's always happened. And actually, just in the last week, a survivor of the Afridi put an advert in Navy News for a presentation or a consecration of some memorial in Namsos of all the people that were there. And John Dunning and I were going to go this week, but it got too involved and too expensive. It would have cost us, about £800 apiece. Because it's a very difficult place to get to, you know. But he was the chap who put this article in the paper was a stoker on the Afridi. He survived. And then he was in Hull for a couple of years, working on boiler cleaning and that. Then he got a commission. What he did after that, I don't know. But his civilian job was a reporter on the Daily Mail, the National Daily Mail. And he has organised this special ceremony in Namsos, which is May time, the anniversary, you know. And he's written a book about his exploits, and it's been published in both English and Norwegian. So that's interesting. Anyway, that was us. We set up. We were not actually directly hit, but near misses from bombs are very, very dangerous on ships because all the shrapnel comes inboard. And we lost a handful of blokes and one officer in that, including one of the chaps who I'd been in the post office with. But to be in Norway, sort of, and suddenly realise that these, I remember saying, the bastards tried to kill me. I couldn't believe it. You know, these aircraft, I thought, the bastards, they tried to kill me. I couldn't believe it. You know, up to then, it was, that was the turning point. The war started, and you started thinking, well, am I going to survive this lot? So that was the first in, you know, and then we came back to Scapa Flow and we got some leave, but not for very long, about a week, I think. And then we rejoined the ship. I think we went down to Plymouth from Scapa Flow. That's right. We got leave from Plymouth, week's leave, rejoined the ship, and sailed for the Eastern Mediterranean because the Italians hadn't come into war then. So we went through, I don't know what year they came in, to be honest, but we went to Gib, and then from Gib to Malta and out to Alexandria to take part in the Eastern Mediterranean, Malta convoys and the like. Which was the same old pattern, of course. It was being bombed to hell most of the time. And one of the things with us being an air cruiser and there being aircraft carriers and other ships in the Eastern Med, our job mainly was to try and protect them as against protecting ourselves, because they were more valuable than we were. So we did a few Malta convoys, lost several ships. I remember losing our four merchant ships, we lost three, and we had a hoping that we could turn back with the other one, because you always had a beginning to get the feeling that you were not going to survive, you know, that something was going to, so many ships were going down, that you began to feel that, you know, life was precious.
When you escorted the convoys to Malta, would you go ashore in Malta? Or
never got there. We just did it three quarters of the way there, you see. We never actually went ashore in Malta when we were doing. And then, of course, the Germans landed in Greece. So we went to Athens, went to Greece, went to Athens. When the Germans were approaching and the army were retreating, and we were given the opportunity of going ashore in Athens, in Piraeus, at night, to try and show the Greeks that the British Navy was there and the like, you know. Personally, I can remember, I never went. Because I thought to myself, God, if I go ashore, I'll be tired out tomorrow and we're going to be attacked. There's no doubt about that. Because we're going to evacuate soldiers, this, that and the other. And I thought, well, I want to try and stay a bit fresh anyway, a bit active. I thought, I don't want to go ashore with the boys and have a few pints. So I didn't go. And then the trouble started, evacuating the New Zealanders and the like. We were bombed all the way back to Crete, but we managed to land most of the soldiers in Crete, and then we had to pick them up again. And then there was the Battle of Crete started. And one particular day when it was really the Navy against the Stukas again, and we were, you know, I think we lost 10 ships on that particular day. There was the Gloucester and quite a list of, they're in the book, I've forgotten all the names. And we were had a direct hit amidships, which was on this number 2 gun, where the RNVRs were, you see. I was still on number 1 gun, still managing to keep clear. And my opposite number, Bob Sylvie, who was on number two gun was still the gun took the weight of the bomb, and the bomb collapsed on Bob Sylvie, and he was still under the gun when we got back to Alex, because they couldn't get him out. We hadn't got the lifting gear to lift the heavy gun off him, you see, so he was still under that when we got back to Alexandria.
You mean he was crushed to death?
Yeah, and he was still under it. And I forgot to tell you, when we were in, we found out later, when we were in Norway, one of the loaded numbers on number two gun, Ted Camplin, he was hit with the machine gun, because these Stukas used to machine gun you as well sometimes. He was hit with a machine gun bullet, which lodged it, the tip of it lodged in the top of his mouth. And he carried on loading his gun in the lake with blood all over. Well, we found out later, it wasn't until 1941, that he got a DSM for the Norwegian campaign, and so did I. Mine was for, the citation was for gallantry and good services in Norwegian waters, but I've forgotten what his was. But his was more an individual thing, whereas mine was more as a representative of the guns crew, I should imagine, anyway. Except the fact that the chief PO, you know, had done 20 years training gunnery in the Navy, disappeared, leaving us to do our best. There was no replacement for him. I think that was one of the faults of the Navy. People were not, they were all in separate divisions. If you were gunnery, you were gunnery. If you were engineer, they didn't train people to do the tasks. Whether they do now, I don't know. But in many cases, if there was a lot at sea, there was a lot of time on people's hands, except when you're actually in action. And they could easily have trained people who had performed similar to do other tasks, so that if ships were hit and people were lost, there was somebody available, you know, to step in into the shoes. I think that was a big fault, especially later on when I joined another ship. So anyway, we were had a direct hit at Crete. We were only working on one screw because what the screw was damaged, and it looked very much as if they'd catch it up with it again and sink us. But we managed to eventually get back to Alexandria.
Can you describe the process of embarkation of troops at Crete?
We didn't actually take any off Crete. We didn't embark off Crete. All we did, we took the troops off from Greece and sort of took them to Crete to land them, and then didn't quite land them, took them back and took them away. So we didn't evacuate Crete as such, because by that time we'd been hit. We did. There were a lot of Greek kayaks, or whatever they're called, with German soldiers on board trying to get from Greece to Crete, and we got in among them and sunk them all.
What do you remember of that?
Well, I just remember it was night time, and on a gun, if you're sinking a ship, you don't have to be very brave, because you don't come in physical contact with it. You know, you sort of load your gun and fire on directions from the transmitting station, the director, or the radar. So all you're doing is following pointers and firing. As far as you're concerned, it could be a practice shoot. But I can remember the Germans in the water and the like as we went through them, because we couldn't stop. You know, we actually went through the men in the water. We couldn't stop.
Were they shouting?
Oh, yeah, screaming and shouting, yes. But at sea at night, and the water deadens all sorts of sound, you know. You don't hear it. It didn't shrill like. It didn't seem to worry me anyway, to the point where I remember it. The worst shouting I heard was We had a merchant ship ahead of us. I don't know whether we were going to Malta or what. And a bomb missed it and blew a lot of Lascars, you know, Lascar seamen, off the stern of the ship in the water. And we had to go through them, past them at about 20 knots. We couldn't stop to pick them up because the submarines in the area bombers coming. And they were shouting and screaming, absolutely. So we slung life belts at them, you know, off the ship and carried on. What happened to them, I don't know.
Where was that?
Pardon?
Where was that?
Where were they?
Whereabouts in the world was that?
This was in the Med. On this, it was either on the Malta convoys or in the Greek, you know. Anyway, we had the patched us up in Alexandria. I was rather fortunate in Alexandria because I had a relative who worked for the Egyptian government. My cousin had married a girl called Colvin, and her father was a go-between between the British Army and the Egyptian government. You know, and he had quite a nice house in Alexandria and made me welcome, so I was able to get away from the general naval going on and go there. And we played rugby in Alexandria. I played for the Carlisle, played the Warspite and the other ships. We had quite a good rugby team on the Carlisle because, you know, Hull lads, Bob Cavanna, for example, he played for Hull Rugby League Club, you know, in the first team as a forward, and Ken Harvey played for Widnsea. We had a Marine Canadian captain who was a good centre. I played on the wing team. I couldn't even keep up with him, so what the hell I was doing on the wing, I don't know. And then when we left Alexandria, we went to the Red Sea and did convoys up and down the Red Sea, bringing the big liners, you know, the really big ones that were bringing the army round to start the push in the desert, bringing them from Aden to Port Sudan. And then in the Bitter Lakes. Well, one night we're at an anchorage in the Bitter Lakes, and we were air guard to this anchorage. And these aircraft came really low, and we never picked them up. And they dropped bombs, and they hit a ship, which was just forward of us. And this ship had a rear range on its deck, for one thing. And it was full of all equipment for the army. And this when it was hit, this railway engine went through the air and landed in the water some hundreds of yards from the ship. Anyway, the ship was sunk. We never got a shot in because we didn't have a chance. Particularly when you're at an anchorage and aircraft coming low, you could only hit other merchant ships. If you know what I mean, you can't open fire for fear of it hitting other escorts or other merchant ships. And we picked some of the crew up off this merchant ship. And then later on, we found out some years after that the owners of the merchant ship, from the moment that ship was sunk, stopped the merchant navy pay. You've maybe heard of this, have you? They actually did. Well, this ship sank to the bottom of comparatively clear water and now is the number one diving place for divers in the world with military. And the ship's apparently on the bottom of the sea with all these motorbikes and jeeps. You've heard of it, have you? Still on the deck. And the railway engine's there. And it is the premier diving site. There have been a few television programmes about it. The Thistledome. You ever heard of it?
No.
Yeah, the Thistledome. It is a, you know, anybody who dives at all will tell you about the Thistledome. There have been TV, I've seen several programmes about it.
Careful.